This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories. U.S. President Donald Trump plans to hold rallies to question the outcome of the presidential vote while Joe Biden prepares to move into the White House. Iran's foreign minister calls on his country's neighbors to cooperate in achieving common interests. And the number of coronavirus cases worldwide exceeds 50 million, with nearly one-fifth of them in the United States. Top story, U.S. President Donald Trump is planning to hold rallies to question the outcome of the vote that gave his Democratic rival Joe Biden a clean sweep in the race for the White House. A Trump campaign spokesman says the president wants to build support for his fight over the election results. The incumbent president does not acknowledge defeat and has launched an array of lawsuits to press claims of election fraud in swing states without producing evidence. Trump has also lambasted the mainstream media for projecting Biden as winner. That's as President-elect Biden has taken the first steps of a transition plan into the White House. He and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris have launched a transition website that lists their four priorities of COVID-19, economic recovery, racial equity, and climate change. The transition website says Biden is assembling a team to tackle the challenges on day one when he formally takes office. Political commentator Cindy Sheehan believes that the 2020 U.S. election, similar to every other election in the country, has been subject to voter fraud.
I think that this basically happens every election. You know, we know here in the United States only about half of the people who are eligible to vote do vote, and then each candidate gets about a little over half or a little under half of the vote. So I'm not surprised at all about by this. And I just want to say I wasn't for Trump, certainly not for Biden, Yeah, my son was killed in Iraq, and Biden was one of the driving forces of getting the U.S. involved in that illegal, immoral, and completely demented and wrong war. And so I'm not a fan of either one of the candidates, but for the mainstream media to declare a winner when the Electoral College hasn't declared a winner, I think Biden's talk of transition is extremely premature. But I know he's been working on his team since even before he had the Democrat nomination for their presidential candidate. So I know that they do this. I know that there's a lot of rhetoric. And if I were Trump, or if I were advising Trump, I certainly wouldn't concede the election either. There is a lot of evidence of voter fraud, as there is always in almost every U.S. election. But this reminds me of 2000, when the noted war criminal George Bush stole that election.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has congratulated U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. Observers see the congratulation as an indication that he will drop his three-year political boycott of the White House. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the West Bank review U.S. President Donald Trump's era as a nightmare, depriving him of their basic rights. Mona Candil reports from West Bank.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has congratulated U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. In a statement, Abbas said he looks forward to working with the president-elect and his administration. Palestinian officials have expressed their satisfaction with the departure of outgoing President Donald Trump and said, for them, nothing was worse than Trump's era.
We welcome the results of the American elections. Like many world states, we agree that Trump's era was a nightmare. As President Abbas said, we are looking forward to achieve freedom, independence, justice, and dignity for our people. All previous U.S. administrations had specific commitments towards Israel, but this time we hope we can cooperate with the new administration.
Several Palestinian political groups have also expressed their satisfaction with, in the first place, the departure of President Donald Trump, the man who took several anti-Palestinian measures, including recognition of Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital in late 2017, moving the U.S. embassy there, and declaring the so-called deal of the century. This had led the Palestinian Authority to halt its political dealings with Trump's administration.
We don't expect to witness a great difference between U.S. administrations and the Israeli regime. But Trump tarnished U.S. image and harmed its interests in the region. I hope Biden can make the U.S. committed to international law. Biden and Trump differ in everything, in performance and reasoning.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was among Trump's close allies around the world, waited 12 hours to congratulate Biden, but at the same time he thanked Trump for taking U.S.-Israel ties to an unprecedented level. For Palestinians, a change of administration in the U.S. is not a promise of change in Washington's policy toward them. However, Palestinians do hope for a gain in Donald Trump's departure, as his term in office is considered the worst even among most hostile U.S. presidents. Murakandi, occupied Ramallah.
Iran has once again reached out to its neighbors, calling for dialogue and cooperation. Earlier, we've discussed that issue in detail with our guests in our news review program.
Welcome to the news review. Iran's foreign minister has called on the country's neighbors to cooperate in achieving common interests following Donald Trump's defeat in the U.S. presidential election. In a tweet in Arabic, Mohammad Javad Zarif stated that, quote, betting on foreigners does points. Zarif described dialogue as the only way tensions. Iran's top diplomat called on regional countries to build a better future together. Tehran has time and again reiterated its adherence to good neighborly relations with the countries in the region. It has also expressed willingness to engage in negotiations to bridge the existing gaps with its neighbors. Joining us is David Yerubian, a professor of history, and we also have Saeb Bishaif, an author and Middle East affairs expert. Gentlemen, welcome. Professor Yerubian, if I can kick it off with you, what do you make of Iran's statements in general, and in particular, Mohammad Javad Zarif's, the foreign minister's comment that regarding Iran's neighbors, betting on foreigners does not bring security and disappoints at the same time.
Well, I think Zarif is really echoing comments that he, as well as President Rouhani, have been making really for several years now, but especially since about a year ago, October of 2019, when the Rouhani administration put forward the HOPE initiative, the Hormuz Peace Endeavor, which it really attempts to create a system of security and dialogue, especially within the Persian Gulf and regionally within the Middle East, that is based on common principles of dialogue, anti-intervention, recognition of sovereignty, of territory, the invariability of international borders, et cetera. And so I think now we have an opportunity to move away from the conflict and tension that has really characterized especially the last year, but really the last several years, particularly difficult under the Trump regime. And so I believe Zarif's speech is putting forward the call once again for regional dialogue and expressing one of his primary points that he makes time and time again and expounded on in his lectures at Tehran University, that security cannot be purchased from outside and that foreigners will never be able to provide the indigenous peoples of Southwest Asia, or really the indigenous peoples or locals, if you will, anywhere around the world, with security. They must create the security with their neighbors, for after all, it is going to be the indigenous peoples of the world where they exist and their neighbors who are ultimately going to have to deal with one another when the United States empire is no longer there to stir the pot and to purposefully direct and guide nations to work against each other's interests and in the interests of the United States.
Right. Mr. Shah, are Iran's neighbors too dependent on America, and do they need to rely on Washington so much?
It's, if you notice, when the Zionist entities, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman, they kept silence about Biden's winning, and they still maybe, God knows, waiting maybe a miracle happens for Trump to be re-elected again. You can recall Netanyahu's and Kushner's plan, which they believed in and relied actually on Trump's victory for the second term, would be followed by Netanyahu's victory as well in the Zionist entities election. And then they bring a massive amount of Arabic countries' normalizations, its ties with the Zionist entity, even Islamic countries. But it didn't occur to the planners, the genius of Kushner and Netanyahu, that Trump will be the only president in the last three decades not to be elected to serve a second term. To do away with their plans, I think Biden will revive two issues, I think, in here. They were a part of the sort of dealing and wheeling within the Democratic Party nomination process between the progressive side and the liberals. One of them would be reviving the nuclear agreement with Iran, since it was an Obama's, Biden's, Smirre administration's achievement. And they want to do that in a way which will avoid any clash with the Zionist entity itself or its lobbies. How are they going to do that? They can configure something. Joe Biden wants to rejoin them, the agreement, and to adopt Obama's as well approach toward two-state solution with the regarding the Palestinian issue. All of that may be demonstrate as a blow to this big plan, which is Kushner and Netanyahu have to create the Zionist entity in the region as a pivotal state, would have Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states will be its satellite. And then under one sort of object to get these states to face Iran and to create Iran as their real enemy. If Biden rejoins the agreement, which I believe will, he does not want to do that, since the Democrats want to focus on the issues at hand. COVID-19, as they created a team right now to deal with it, the Democrats, under, of course, Biden administration, and jump-starting the economy as well. So the Democrats and Joe Biden's administration doesn't have a dime to waste on the Netanyahu's dreams. This is the new sort of way you're going to see in the region.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Very interesting points raised there. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Let me thank our guest, David Yerubian, a professor of history from San Bernardino, and also Saeb Shah, author and Middle East affairs expert, joining us out of Belfast. And thank you for staying tuned to this edition of the News Review.
The number of global coronavirus infections has surpassed the 50 million mark as the world is grappling with a new wave of the pandemic. The Johns Hopkins University data shows October was the worst month for the pandemic. The latest seven-day average indicates global daily cases are rising by more than 540,000. More than 1.25 million people have so far died of the disease. This is Europe with around 12 million cases is the world's the world's worst affected region. The United States has about 20% of the total global cases. Its infections now are nearing the 10 million mark, with more than 237,000 fatalities. In Asia, India has the world's second highest caseload, where the total cases have exceeded 8.5 million. Iran has reported its highest daily fatalities from COVID-19 since the disease broke out there in mid-February. Health Ministry spokeswoman Seema Sadat-Ladi said nearly 460 people lost their lives to the virus in the past 24 hours. That takes Iran's total deaths to more than 38,000. She added infections increased by over 9,200. The figure brings the country's total confirmed cases to more than 682,000. Iranian government has put new restrictions across the country to curb the spread of the virus. Authorities have warned that daily tallies will further spike if people fail to observe health protocols. Humam Abedi in Tehran says the recent surge in Iran's coronavirus infections is partly due to an increase in the number of testing.
Seeing people losing their lives is really saddening, and as experts put it, if the people would not observe protocols as strictly, this number would hit 900 within the next month. As far as I'm concerned, there are two reasons for the spike in Iran's death and infection numbers. It seems that the danger, of the virus has lost its significance among people, and therefore they do not take the warnings seriously. On the other hand, the second reason that I can tell you, in my opinion, is that increased number of the tests performed has led to a dramatic spike in cases diagnosed. Iran in recent weeks has boosted its testing capacity from 20,000 to 40,000, which has in turn raised the number of identified cases to unprecedented highs.
Coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip are on the rise amid a fragile health system in the impoverished enclave. Gaza lacks enough resources to fight the pandemic due to the Israeli blockade. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon brings us more from the besieged enclave.
Coronavirus cases among the general population are rapidly increasing in the Gaza Strip as over 200 infections are being discovered daily. The first community spread of the deadly virus was detected in late August, and over 8,000 cases have been discovered so far. Health officials have sounded the alarm over the rising figures in the densely populated enclave.
The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is high, and we are extremely worried due to the rising number. We are doing our best to deal with the situation. We are working around the clock to detect infections.
The coronavirus has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. COVID-19 has threatened the socioeconomic welfare of nearly 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here don't have access to preventive equipment because they are crash-strapped. They can hardly provide food for their families.
People have been suffering from the Israeli blockade, and now the situation has only gotten worse because of the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. Gaza's health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies.
14 years of the inhumane Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip have taken their toll on the humanitarian, health, and economic situation. The Israeli blockade has left the health system in Gaza in ruin, making it unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the Gaza Strip, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
As infections continue to rise, rights groups are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the deadly coronavirus. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
And that's it with international news.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
All-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
President Donald Trump refused to formally concede the U.S. election on Saturday, 7th of November, even as senior Republicans began to distance themselves from him, as recriminations were reported among aides to a man doomed to go down as an impeached one-term president. Before the race was called, Donald Trump continued to tweet his defiance and to attract censure for making baseless claims about voter fraud and his supposed victory. He also went to his golf course in Virginia to play golf. Whilst he played, a defiant statement was issued in his name. The article you're about to hear has been written by Guardian journalists Edward Helmore and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Donald Trump Refuses to Concede Defeat as Recriminations Begin. Stay with us for more of Edward Helmore and Martin Pengelly's article. President Donald Trump refused to formally concede the U.S. election on Saturday, 7th of November, even as senior Republicans began to distance themselves from him, as recriminations were reported among aides to a man doomed to go down as an impeached one-term president. Before the race was called, Donald Trump continued to tweet his defiance and to attract censure for making baseless claims about voter fraud and his supposed victory. He also went on to his golf course in Virginia to play golf. Whilst he played, a defiant statement was issued in his name. The simple fact is that this election is far from over, Trump insisted. Joe Biden has not been certified as the winner of any states, let alone any of the highly contested states headed for a mandatory recount. or states where our campaign has valid and legitimate legal challenges that could determine the ultimate victor. The statement was of a piece with previous tweets and statements since the election on Tuesday, angry, refusing to admit defeat, and alleging improprieties by his opponent without providing evidence. The American people are entitled to an honest election, Donald Trump said. That means counting all legal ballots and not counting any illegal ballots. This is the only way to ensure the public has full confidence in our election. It remains shocking that the Biden campaign refuses to agree with this basic principle and wants ballots counted even if they are fraudulent, manufactured, or cast by ineligible or deceased voters. Only a party engaged in wrongdoing would unlawfully keep observers out of the count room and then fight in court to block their access. None of what Donald Trump alleges has been proven to be true. Nonetheless, Republicans and Republican legal challenges in key states are set to continue, leading the effort to marshal a legal force like the one which led the party to victory in 2000 Florida recount were Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr., and his younger brother Eric Trump, as well as Rudy Giuliani, the former New York mayor. Beginning on Monday, Donald Trump added, our campaign will start prosecuting our case in a court of law to ensure election laws are fully upheld and the rightful winner is seated. So what is Biden hiding? I will not rest until American people have the honest vote count they deserve and that democracy demands. Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, has largely stayed quiet in the last few days. Nowhere to be seen is an army of lawyers of the size and skill Donald Trump will need. The failure to assemble a coherent legal team and to raise as much as $60 million to fund attempts to stop vote counts in some swing states and continue them in others was in many ways a reflection of previous failures among the small circle of mostly family advisors that Donald Trump has kept around him. What a campaign needs to do to staff one statewide recount, let alone multiple recounts, is overwhelming, according to Benjamin Ginsburg, a top Republican lawyer who was national counsel to George W. Bush in 2000 and 2004. In an interview with CNN, Benjamin Ginsburg said, Bush versus Gore was one state, Florida. We put out a call and hundreds of lawyers, political operatives, and many others responded. Even with that, it taxed the party to its limits to do just one state. It is at best unproven that the Trump campaign can command the sort of infrastructure they would really need to pull this off. The legal challenge to Biden's victory was placed in the hands of Jay Sekulow, who defended the president during the Mueller investigation and the impeachment process, and Rudy Giuliani, who went to Philadelphia to publicly demand Republican operatives be granted greater oversight over the Pennsylvania vote count. Apparently, Rudy Giuliani learned about Joe Biden's win from reporters and journalists in Philadelphia. Among experts dismissing Donald Trump's legal moves was James Baker, who led the effort for George W. Bush in Florida, which wrested the White House from Al Gore. It was reported this week that Jared Kushner was placing calls from the Trump War Room in search of his own version of James Baker, a former Chief of Staff, Treasury Secretary, and Secretary of State. Baker has backed Donald Trump, but he told the New York Times that 20 years ago, we never said don't count the votes. That's a very hard decision to defend in a democracy. Trump advisors have reportedly raised the prospect of defeat. According to the Washington Post, some have advocated that the president should offer public remarks committing to a peaceful transfer of power. One senior Trump aide, however, said there had been no discussion of a formal concession. Some supporters in the media have begun to back away. Late on Friday, 6th of November, the Fox News host Laura Ingraham, an ardent Trump loyalist, advised the president to accept defeat should it come with grace and composure. Laura Ingraham also railed at failed consultants and campaign officials who blew through hundreds of millions of dollars without the legal apparatus in place to challenge what we all knew was coming. Why aren't the best lawyers in America on television night after night explaining the president's legal claims? Ingraham asked. The New York Post also changed its tune. In October, the paper called Trump an invincible hero who survived every dirty trick the Democrats threw at him. But on Thursday, the New York Post accused Donald Trump of making an unfounded claim that political foes were trying to steal the election. Support from Republicans in Congress was notably tepid. On Friday, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said only every legal vote should be counted. Any illegal submitted ballots must not be counted. All sides must get to observe the process, and the courts are here to apply the laws and resolve disputes. As night drew in on Saturday, Donald Trump returned to Twitter. Among more baseless claims of malpractice, he bragged that he had received 71 million legal votes, the most ever for a sitting president. That much was true if the number was rounded up. Trump's challenger, however, Joe Biden, had 4 million more votes than Trump.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
economic divide.
Like many nations in South America, Bolivia has been through a lot in the last few years, with events such as the ousting of previous President Evo Morales to the impact of the COVID-19 virus. Yet it seems that there is light at the end of the tunnel, at least in words, as the new president, Luis Arce, has promised to rebuild Bolivia. In the recent election, Arce swept to a landslide victory, winning some 55% of the votes against six other rivals on the ballot paper. But the importance of this election is the fact that Arce was the previous finance minister under Morales, hence giving hope to the electorate that the economy can emerge from the ashes. With the victory of Arce, former President Evo Morales has stated that he would now seek to return to his homeland, claiming that the new president-elect was a man who would prove that the economy could be turned around, and the belief in the party and system was the reason that Arce won the election so easily. Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Omid Roshandel. On this week's show, we are going to look at the economy of Bolivia and ascertain whether the new president can use his financial experience to bring the Andean nation out of the red and back into the black. Well, have the resurgence in the party and policies once led by Morales shown that people are unhappy with the current status in Bolivia? Under Morales, for example, extreme poverty fell from 33% of the population to just 15%, showing that Morales' model and management give the poorest deciles some hope. Morales also invested heavily in the infrastructure of the country, building roads, health clinics, and schools, as well as taking the decision to nationalize both the oil and gas industries, which in all cases just mentioned, not only provided a service to the people of the country, but also created jobs and income. With Arce at the helm of the finance ministry, Morales also managed to accumulate around $15 billion of international reserves, equating to around 50% of the GDP, bringing more people out of poverty and seeing the inequality level measures on the Gini index fall from 58 to 44 points.
South America is a particularly important geopolitical area when it comes to the pendulum of the left versus right political battle. On the one hand, many South American nations have embraced the notion of left-wing-based politics, be it socialism or communism, but the point of view does not appease the foreign states, who make it their business to interfere in those such nations, and hence sees the likes of the United States, for example, place pressure on such countries, aimed ultimately at destabilizing the left. One only has to take a look at the example of Venezuela and the US distaste at the leadership of Nicolas Maduro, and the case of Cuba with the US history against Castro, and of course the dissatisfaction at the leadership in Bolivia that ultimately saw the president, Evo Morales, upstage from his seat and removed from power in a coup. But skip forward to today, and Bolivia has once again found itself swinging to the left with the election of Luis Arce, the former finance minister of Evo Morales, who swept to victory and in doing so has promised to revive the Bolivian economy like never before. With over a decade in the role of finance minister under Morales, Arce should have the experience necessary to make educated economic and financial decisions.
I think it's going to help enormously. He had 10 years' experience as a finance minister. He is very highly regarded in international circles. He presided over a period of rapid economic growth and also significant improvements in poverty reduction. So it's altogether quite a positive scenario for the future.
Yet the election results in Bolivia, although accepted by the challenger, Carlos Mesa, has seen the rise of the Movement for Socialism, or the MAS party, led by Arce, spark some protests in the process, with many believing that Arce's links to Morales could see the former president return to some notion of power in the country. It's highly likely that Arce will take the issue with an air of caution, keeping Morales at arm's length as he sets to rebuild the Bolivian economy. With many nations around the world congratulating Arce on his victory, surprisingly, the US has also stepped forward with praise, recognizing the credible election process. However, it now remains to be seen as to whether the capitalist US maintain their views on the socialist Bolivians in the future, and whether the message of support is merely a disguise to be ready to stop other Latin American nations following suit.
Is Bolivia being used as a political pawn by the US?
Bolivia is a very rich nation when it comes to natural resources, with the nation enjoying around 140 million tons of lithium resources buried beneath its famed salt flats, which is estimated to account for around 70% of the world's total lithium reserves, and is something that many have their eyes on. Just last year, Bolivia signed an agreement with China to the value of an initial $2.3 billion investment into the lithium available in the country, with the Chinese eyeing the use of the resource to fuel the emerging battery-powered electric vehicle market, which is estimated to be valued at over $115 billion and expected to grow fivefold by 2026. It is hence why the U.S. were keen to see Morales go, as the U.S. only have a trade value with Bolivia to the figure of around $1 billion, with goods exported to Bolivia valued at $562 million, whilst imports, including lithium, are at $486 million.
The arrival of the coronavirus in Bolivia immediately took its toll on the recent elections held in the nation, with the original election date set to last May. However, in order to stem the rising number of cases, it was decided by the electoral bodies to postpone the election for the sake of keeping the virus in check. Yet much like the rest of South America, Bolivia is no exception when it comes to the virus, as at the time of writing, the country has seen a total of 141,000 confirmed cases of infection, with around 8,700 deaths, which compared to other nations, is still relatively low in numbers. Much like everywhere else in the world, the country has had to introduce some forms of lockdown in the bigger cities, which of course has led to store closures, offices winding down, and many other commercial and economic premises taking a hit, which for a small nation like Bolivia can have a devastating impact on their economy. With the nation receiving several loans to help it emerge from the pandemic, for example, a $254 million loan from the World Bank, how then is the Bolivian economy coping with the virus and other loans being granted to them? A benefit or a hindrance?
Bolivia has been affected by coronavirus, and it's not clear that how exact the data is coming out about that. It certainly underscores the need for a well-funded, accessible health service, which is an absolute priority to build up, and it's entirely appropriate that political leaders turn their attention to that. But with regards to the loans, that's a more worldwide question, I think. I think the IMF are strongly encouraging countries to take out loans, which is an interesting turn of events in itself.
For Bolivia, tourism is also a major source of income. However, the arrival of the virus has also taken its tolls on this sector, with the pandemic believed to be responsible for around $890 million of losses for the Bolivian Tourist Board, with around 530 million of that coming from domestic tourism and 360 million coming from inbound tourism. For the many indigenous people of Bolivia, the arrival of the COVID-19 virus is of particular importance, especially for the more isolated or rural communities who are already less exposed to viruses than others and have little or no access to healthcare facilities. For some people in the country, they've turned to traditional forms of medicine to help them through. However, as the global results have shown when it comes to dealing with the virus, the consequences of corona have been devastating, with over 1 million dead worldwide. The struggle continues for both Bolivia and the rest of the world.
Joining me in the studio today is Diego Sanchez Ancochea, a professor of political economy development from the University of Oxford. He specializes in the development and economies of Latin American nations and has work published in various journals, including World Development and the Journal of Latin American Studies, as well as having co-edited numerous books. His current work focuses on explaining why some Latin American countries are more unequal than others. Professor, many thanks for joining our show today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and for the invitation. It's great to be here.
Well, my first question is about Bolivia itself. We have seen that the finance minister, Luis Arce, has won a landslide victory in the election and has immediately promised to help the economy of the country grow. Now, my question is, what kind of challenges is he going to face in delivering on his promises?
So I think we should remember that Bolivia has faced, like the rest of Latin America, the combination of a health crisis, an economic crisis, and in the Bolivian case, a political crisis as well in the last few months. So I think there will be two big challenges. The first is, how do they get the money from the public accounts to fund projects that are very much needed? and the other is how do you regain political stability and sometimes of collaboration between different groups on society that have been split in recent years.
Thank you. Now, your current work focuses on how Latin American nations, some of them, are more unequal than others. And my question is, how is Bolivia able to establish itself as a serious economic player in the region and beyond?
It's a great question. So Bolivia historically has been one of the most unequal countries, particularly between the indigenous population and the small white elite. But during the Morales administration in the last decade and decade and a half, actually things improved a lot. So Latin America Bolivia reduced inequality more than any other Latin American country. Of course, the big question is whether with a new president we can start back trying to reduce inequality and promote development or not, and we'll have to see in the next few months and years.
Finally, like many nations in Latin America, indigenous people play a huge part in the economics and politics of the country. How have indigenous people in Bolivia contributed to the economy of the country, and is this unwavering support for Morales and Arce a good sign for the future of the country and maybe other Latin American nations?
So, another great question. So, Morales' project was very much about trying to incorporate indigenous peoples and increase their political rights. And as a result, actually, a new middle class of indigenous peoples emerged, and indigenous peoples as a political force also present in the government also appeared, and it was important. The last few months, the government that replaced Morales tried to actually reverse some of these gains, but I am very hopeful that Arce will start or enhance the power of indigenous peoples, and we might actually see a new renewal of a Latin America that has more success at reducing inequalities and bringing indigenous rights to the forefront.
Professor Diego Sanchez Ancochea from the University of Oxford, many thanks for being on the show today. It was lovely hearing your thoughts on this topic.
Great talking to you, and I look forward to future occasions.
All right. Make sure you check out Professor Sanchez Ancochea's upcoming book, which is titled The Cost of Inequality in Latin America, published by I.B. Torres, and available for pre-order now from the usual outlets. Bolivia, as we know, is the world's largest producer of lithium. Let's now take a look at how lithium is playing a part in one of the world's most lucrative emerging markets in our next report.
Bolivia is said to hold around 25% of the world's total lithium resources, with some estimates placing it as high as 70%. Along with Chile and Argentina, Bolivia make up the so-called lithium triangle, with the metal being concentrated in various salt plains around South America, covering the Atacama Desert and its neighboring areas. Some have called the exploration and mining of the metal as the White Gold Rush, with a total value on the market of an estimated $5.9 billion across the world, with the potential of the market rising in the near future, in part sparked by one certain industry. With the world paying more attention to the carbon footprint issue, many of the world's leading car makers are now turning their attention to the electric car market, which, as we all know, relies heavily on batteries inside the vehicles, which, of course, are mainly fueled by lithium. Sales of electric cars topped 2.1 million units in 2019, with total electric car sales accounting for 2.6% of the global market. However, zero-emission vehicles are set to rise dramatically over the next decade, with diesel vehicle production for one seeing an eventual phase-out, followed by likely, one day, petrol. One of the biggest emerging markets in the electrical vehicle production line is China, who are already home to the largest number of electrical vehicle charging points in the world, suggesting that the Chinese will no doubt be eyeing the rest of the world for them to place their electrical vehicles, hence competing with some very big players. So will Bolivia's vast resources of lithium come to the rescue of the Bolivian economy, in particular when it comes to assisting in the production of batteries for electric vehicles?
It's a bit complicated. Bolivia forms part of what's called the lithium triangle with Argentina and Chile. And frankly, both Argentina, but particularly Chile, have moved faster than Bolivia had in terms of developing those resources. Bolivia has one quarter of the known resources of in the world of lithium. The problem is it's found at a higher altitude than in Chile and Argentina, and technically it is more complicated to produce lithium hydroxide or lithium carbonate, which is the key compound which is used for batteries.
But should Bolivia instead be wary and consider the notion of killing two birds with one stone? When Evo Morales was in power, he suggested that Bolivia should not only produce the lithium to sell abroad to make batteries, but also consider the idea of building the batteries themselves, hence adding another layer to the economy, and leaving something for Arce to consider in his upcoming term, and promise of rebuilding the economy.
I'm pleased to welcome back into the studio our regular current affairs and impact analyst, Mohan Albedin. Mohan, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
So, people in Bolivia have made a very bold political statement by electing Arce, the former finance minister. But what are the economic impacts of this election on the country?
Well, absolutely. So, it was a surprise electoral victory a week or so ago. So, the socialists are back. Now, we have the tweet here, victory against U.S. imperialism. Well, yes, but then the really serious issues about rebuilding partnerships with China and just generally going back to the Evo Morales philosophy of building the country from bottom up. And, of course, in Bolivia, the story isn't just political. It's,
right.
It's social, it's kind of ethnic, because Morales, if you like, he represented or he purported to represent the indigenous people. Who have historically been dispossessed and impoverished in Bolivia. So this is a really big story. And I think the victors in this election have got their work cut out, to be honest, in terms of putting the economy on a stable footing.
So yeah. Next.
So Luis Arce's most pressing challenge, economy, obviously, like everywhere else, is a huge concern for the Bolivians, more so than COVID-19. So again, this just speaks to the big challenges ahead, really. Let's not forget, this is an impoverished country. Even by Latin American standards, it's very poor. But I would add to that the foreign policy challenge, or at least the regional challenge, because Bolivia now is in a kind of a hostile environment. You have Brazil that has this kind of looks to Trump. So by extension, they're an enemy of Bolivia. You have Colombia, which is very belligerent, led by a right-wing regime. Their only ally, really, is Venezuela, and they have problems of their own. So, third and final tweet you have. So, it's had good growth, big reductions in poverty. It's a mixed picture, really. So, I mean, under Morales, they followed this Venezuelan policy of helping the indigenous people. The only problem with that is if you focus on one group, so by extension, by definition, you're going to impoverish or at least disadvantage another group. I think what this new Bolivian regime needs above all is to show national unity, to demonstrate it can look after the economic well-being of all the Bolivian people. And I think that is the route to success for them. Because if you read from this tweet, and this is very accurate actually, it captures all their problems in a very pithy tweet. But So really, they need a holistic approach.
To wrap it up, I can say we are hopeful, but it's not going to be easy.
This was a very pleasant victory, I think. I think it puts aside all the difficulties from last year, because last year there was an ugly coup in Bolivia. There was a lot of violence. A lot of people were hurt. This, at least, is an opportunity to correct those wrongs.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they can get the good policies in place, they have a good future, I think.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today as well. That was Mohan Albedin, our regular current affairs and impact analyst. Now, in our final report today, we take a look at how Bolivia compares to and interacts with its neighboring countries in Latin America. So stay right where you are.
South America, as we recently discovered in our recent program right here on Economic Divide, where we covered the Inter-American Development Bank, is a highly complex continent, especially when one studies it on an economic level. On the one hand, you have a country such as Brazil, a nation that sits comfortably in the top 10 of the world's largest GDPs, with over $2.05 trillion per year income, and hence making it a key emerging power. On the other hand, you have a country like Argentina, a nation which is on the verge of a second financial crisis and is about to see its currency plummet in value. Across South America, there's also a whole host of layers in between. For Bolivia, relations with its neighbours is highly important, in particular as Bolivia is a landlocked country and access to ports are limited. It's hence why Bolivia and Chile, for example, have clashed in the past when it comes to this particular benefit. So how are Bolivian relations with their neighbours now?
That region, like you've mentioned, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, they're also they're the big players in that region. Bolivia gets compared more often to Peru. One of the key challenges for Bolivia is really to turn its economy away from reliance on natural resources. So diversifying the economy in general, which could include some exploitation of natural resources, but diversifying it so there's not so much of a reliance is key.
But it's not just nation states that Bolivia interact with the nation also playing a role in liaising with international institutions, which also see relations appearing to look promising for Bolivia.
Internationally, with the International Monetary Fund, relations I think are probably going to be not as bad as people might think. IMF has recently been going through a kind of mea culpa, and there's noticeable shift in its approach to poverty reduction and income distribution and taxation of international wealth. So I think RSA in some ways fits the mould there with this new thinking in the IMF.
However, like many other nations in South America, it's the interaction with the US that ultimately many want to address. The arrival of Evo Morales certainly soured ties between the two, with the unionist Morales proving popular with farmers and locals in Bolivia as he sought to eradicate US policy in the country, going as far to say that wherever there's a US ambassador, there's a coup. How right he was. As mentioned earlier in the show, with the arrival of Arce at the helm and Pompeo sending his wishes, will the US's warm approach to Bolivia be nothing more than a wolf in sheep's clothing?